And we'll begin with Mr. David Fleurant of Alaska Legal Services, who's going to discuss allotments for us. So, well, I hope so.
Thank you, Justice Berger. As he indicated, my name is Dave Fleurant, and I'm the Native Allotment Coordinator for Alaska. I'm the Native Allotment Coordinator for Alaska Legal Services. Legal Services receives a grant from the Bureau of Indian Affairs to assist Native Allotment applicants in pursuing their allotment claims. Basically, in what that means in hard terms is that if you have any questions or problems with your Native allotment, you can come to Legal Services. If you have to go to a hearing, we will represent you, and it doesn't cost you anything. I've been asked to speak to you on Native allotments because it appears there's been some confusion about the relationship or the lack of relationship between the Native allotment law and the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. From my own observations and sitting in on these hearings, I'm beginning to get a feel for where some of these problems or where some of this confusion lies. But let me begin by briefly running through the history of the Allotment Act. The Allotment Act was passed in 1906. 1906. And what it provided was a mechanism or a way for natives of Alaska to apply for land, a mechanism by which they could acquire title to land. As I understand it, as we all know, at the turn of the century, there was a gold rush in Alaska in several different areas, so you had the influx of a lot of white settlers. What they would do is they would find a tract of land which they wanted and then file a homestead claim on it. If there happened to be an Alaska native there, they would generally just chase them off, and there was no way for the Alaska native to acquire title at that time to those lands that they used. So the federal government passed the Native Allotment Act, allowing Alaska natives to apply for up to 160 acres of land, which they used in, say, pursuit of their subsistence lifestyle, be it their hunting area, their fishing camp, their trapping area. The basic requirements set for acquiring a Native allotment was that the land had to be, as they say in the Act, vacant, unappropriated, and unreserved at the time you entered the land. Yeah, I'll explain those. The time of entry is when you first started using the land. Vacant, unappropriated, and unreserved means that no one else was using it. They don't look more to, I don't think they care too much as to whether or not your family members were using it. They're more concerned with whether or not the federal government had taken this land and set it aside for like a lighthouse or for a military reserve or for a national forest. That's what they meant by vacant, unappropriated, and unreserved. Like, you couldn't file an allotment application for land which had been included in someone's homestead application. Okay, it had to be vacant, i.e. no one else was using it or had applied for it. This perhaps is really applicable in the Southeast, where we had the Tongass Forest withdrawals. They ranged from 1902 through to about 1925 or 1926. A series of acts generally increasing the size of the Tongass Forest. Well, when it came time to apply for land, there was very little vacant and unappropriated land. In order to apply for it, you had to predate the forest, which was, say, 1902. And, you know, that was a really tough requirement to fill. You had to be quite old, actually. We did file suit, in fact, down in the southeast, trying to get a lot tease their land, even though they didn't predate the forest. And we lost. We actually requested the Supreme Court of the United States to review the case, and they denied. So we lost there. The Allotment Act also states that your allotment is not to exceed 160 acres. Initially, this was viewed as one tract of land, one 160-acre tract. Through policy changes and regulation changes, this eventually was interpreted to, say, it can be up to four tracts of 40 acres each. It can vary. You can have an 80-acre tract and two 40s. You can have a 30-acre tract. It's not set to any particular acreage, as long as your allotments do not exceed 160 acres total.
You say six tracts?
It would be, usually what it is, if people want to get as many tracts as possible, they would have applied for four tracts of land, say of 40 acres apiece. One would be, say, their fishing site, another one would be their year-round cabin, or maybe a trapping area or a berry picking area. In some areas there aren't any berries, or there aren't any streams for fishing, so one might be an 80 acre parcel. The concern was that when you add them all up, it cannot go over 160 acres. Another requirement of the Native Allotment Act was that the land could not be mineral in nature. It had to be non-mineral land. Essentially, what that means is, if you have gold or platinum or any what they call locatable minerals, you could not get your land. Even if you fill the requirements of the act, you could not get that land. There are certain qualifications to that, such as it had to be a marketable commodity at the time you actually entered the land. For instance, if there was no market for platinum, if you started using your land in 1930 and no one was doing anything with platinum, and now they were just reviewing your claim and platinum is a very high commodity thing, that doesn't matter. Because it's based on the time you entered the land. One change that has occurred, and this occurred, I believe, in 1926, although the date's, I'm not too sure of the date, is for oil, gas, and coal. You can get land which is over oil, gas, and coal reserves, but you do not get the oil, gas, or coal. The federal government reserves that. So you own the surface estate, and essentially you own the subsurface estate, the underground. But you have no rights to the fossil fuel, the oil, gas, or coal. The federal government can convey that to the state or to the village, the regional corporations, which can acquire subsurface rights. So you will get what they call as a mineral reservation. That is something, a letter which they send to you, saying that your land has been deemed potentially valuable for oil, gas, or coal, and so if your allotment is conveyed to you, those rights to the oil, gas, and coal will be reserved in the federal government. Please? Well, it will be reserved to the federal government, but the federal government can in turn convey it to the state. It's just that you don't get it. Of course, if they don't do that and they convey you your title free and clear and you later discover oil on your land, congratulations. Another requirement of the act is that the applicant must be a full or mixed blood be they Indian, Eskimo, Aleut. It really hasn't become an issue as to how much of a mixture you need, but it seems like it can go even lower than a quarter blood, which I think is the cutoff for the claims, if I'm not mistaken.
Were many of the allotments taken out in several parcels, or were most of them taken out in one big 160-acre plot?
Initially, your early allotments were taken out in one 160-acre plots because that's the way the law, that's the way the law was interpreted at that time. However, as I'll get to later on, most of the allotment applications were filed after that policy change. So I would have to say now that most allotment applications involve two to three parcels on the average. Another requirement of the Act, and this goes to proving up on your claim, is that your use of the land had to be substantially continuous for a period of 5 years. What they're saying is it can't be intermittent. You can't go there 1 year and skip another year and maybe go back the following year. What they're looking for is an area of land that you perhaps return to each year, like your fishing camp. Most people always return to their same fishing camp. Same thing with a trapping area. You don't have to go every year. There's not that continuous or consecutive requirement, but it has to be substantially continuous. You can skip a year here or there, but other than that, they might start looking down on your claim.
Is there any minimum number of years? Did I miss something there?
It has to be for a period of 5 years. The way it's interpreted now is if you started using your land, say, in 1960 and you applied in 1971, you could, say, use your land in 1960 and maybe skip for 2 years, then use it for 4 years and maybe skip a year, and then use it, say, up into 1971. And they would consider that as having your 5 years use and occupancy. It's not 5 years in a row, but within a 10-year period of time, you've used it for 7 years, and that's sufficient. If you applied for land which you hadn't used yet, which is not uncommon, and you began using it from the date you applied, then they require you to file 5 years of use and occupancy within a 6-year period of time. So it does become more consecutive if you've applied for land which you have never used. And the last requirement that I'll mention is that they want your use to be at least potentially exclusive of others. Yeah, it is a problem area. They require that your land be used potentially exclusive of others. Again, what they're trying to get to here is that you use your land and no one else uses it for the same reason. Or if other people do use your land, they use it with your permission and with the knowledge that it is your land. What they're trying to get to is this private property concept. In that what they don't want you to do actually is apply for community land. Is if you had a berry picking area right outside the village that everyone used, what they didn't want to see happen is you applying for that land, which although you used it, everyone else did too. What they wanted you to apply for was land which you used and no one else actually used.
But that's not the way the Eskimos do.
I know.
Like the way you live. We share. So they're just trying to make, so if she's got an allotment, you're saying that I'm not going over there to do my fishing. So with the natives, even from way back, they share. He could fish in the river where my allotment is. That's the way the natives do it.
I realize that the the traditional Native way is not to have this concept of private property and do what the white man does, is erect a fence around his to keep other people off. And that is one of the problems with the act, in that it's trying to convey a concept that is foreign to your culture. We run across problems with this when we argue this point at hearings. We'll ask other people if they viewed, say, your allotment as your land. And usually the response will be, oh yeah, I recognized her allotment as her land once she applied for it. And it was only at that point that most people started looking at land as actually belonging to someone else because you had filed on it. Prior to that time, people may have recognized that you used a particular area, perhaps more so than anyone else. For instance, your fish camp may always be in the same place, but you would never exclude anyone from it. People would recognize that as your fish camp, not necessarily as your land. So the concept gets real fuzzy in there, and the way the law has been interpreted has been along white man's definition of it and not the Native culture.
Because in some areas, especially in the river, there's always certain place where the fish is. And like in his allotment, there was noticed that at that time. And if he wants to come to this area where there's fish, where my allotment is, then that's how we share, because we don't...
Yeah, well, we realize that, and we try and convey that to the judges who are making the decisions, although we're not always successful. Again, they tend to interpret the act as the white man has defined exclusive use.
But if he wants to build primary allotment, I don't think I would allow him to build a cabin around my allotment.
There's a real...
what you're saying is that the way the act worked was that if a Native person and his family were using land exclusively,
mm-hmm.
and no one else was using it, if it was that family's land, then they could get an allotment. But if there was heavily used land by many people, that is really land used by the whole community, there was no way of protecting it.
Right. I have problems with that concept of like protecting and excluding others, because again, it is not part of the Native culture. Perhaps one thing that they wanted to avoid was people filing for land which encompassed the village, say, of Barrow, where you know, you do have community use there. And even though you yourself might qualify as an applicant because you have used, of course, the land in the city of Barrow, or what was the village of Barrow, so didn't a lot of others. So they wanted to avoid that occurrence. And...
One certain family has a house or a sod house in an ice cellar. They could apply for that because they used it as a family?
You couldn't apply for it as a family. The allotment application, of course, is specific to the applicant. But yes, if you had...
Could you repeat that question?
Your question was if there is a house or a sod house and an ice house on a particular...
Ice cellar.
On a particular tract of land, could you apply for that land which encompassed the house?
Well, the family that owns the house in Iceland, they could apply for the 160 acres, right?
Okay, yes, they could. You could apply for land on which you had made or developed or constructed something. Again, one thing to keep in mind is 160 acres is a large tract of land. And if you had your ice cellar and your sod house in the middle of town, you could perhaps apply for the land immediately surrounding your ice cellar and your sod house, But you couldn't apply for a full 160 acres there, because I'm sure that would include your neighbor's house, which they had built and they have a right to file on. So to that extent, you're limited as to the amount of acreage you could apply for within a close setting like that. If this ice cellar and the sod house, say, were out along the coast somewhere and there was no one else around you, you could apply for a full 160 acres then, because you wouldn't be conflicting with anyone else's use or anyone else's claim. So you do have a right. In fact, that's one of the pieces of evidence of proving up on a claim, is that, well, I built this on my land, or I had constructed this on my land. As I'll get into later on, what they generally do is a field exam. BLM will do a field exam of your land to see if there are any signs of use and occupancy. And one of the more obvious signs is a dwelling, or say a fish rack or a cache.
Did you say that the land allotment was passed in 1906?
Yeah.
And if a family could prove that they lived in that area for 5 consecutive years, but there's nothing in writing, how could they go about proving that they lived in that certain area for 5 years?
Okay.
And also, during the time my parents were growing up and, you know, maturing as adults, there was lack of communication because there was no mail that was thrown into to where they were living. There were no airports, nothing like that.
Okay. Your question goes to...
Could we just stop for a minute? These questions are really quite good. And
do you want to get a mic?
Well, I was just going to say... Why don't we ask Eileen to use the third mic? Because there's nobody that can't understand what's being said. And that way, my
insurance
record okay. Actually will show these questions, which are quite good.
What I was going to ask you, though, is I will be getting to that, your questions on use and occupancy and the fact that many people did not know about the Act. If I can... say, just continue on this little format. If I don't answer your questions as I go along, you certainly interrupt me, and I'll answer your questions as best as I can. Oh, good.
Is that the mic working?
Yes.
Maybe if you don't mind, we could just ask this gentleman's name and get him to repeat his question.
Sure.
Could we have your name, sir, and could you just repeat that question? And
my name is Joe Quinnigan. I'm from Milton.
And do you want to just repeat that question? It was about how can you do it if there's nothing in writing, sort of thing.
Forgot what I asked. For one thing, how could they prove that the land allotment was passed in 1906, right? And they lived in that one specific area, and they lived for 5 years in that specific area. But how could they prove it? Because they have nothing in writing. The only thing that they could prove to you is by talking to you orally.
And generally, that would be okay. Again, briefly, when they do the field exam, they'll go on to the allotment, and they'll look for signs of use and occupancy. And if there's, say, up here it wouldn't apply, but if there are stumps from trees that have been cut, you can generally tell if it was a recent cut or an old cut. If there's a dwelling that's been constructed, they generally try and determine how long that dwelling had been there. Or if there are ruins, how long perhaps it had been in ruin, and try and get an estimate. Another approach to gathering evidence would be asking people in the village how long that person has lived there. Generally, they will accept your word on it if the facts about the land itself substantiate or support your claim. say you're claiming a particular tract of land for berry picking, well, hopefully that land will contain some berries. So the resources are there for your claim juice. There's perhaps a hut where you used to stay when you were berry picking, which I know is not very common. But those types of facts would kind of indicate that, yes, your claim is valid, and the people of the village recognize that area as yours. So you wouldn't need anything in writing.
I think the other question I asked was, if a certain family had an ice cellar and a sod house in a specific area of land, they could file for 160 acres. But if there's other people living around the vicinity of the tract that they could apply for, they could apply for only for the minimum or the maximum they could get within that tract land.
Right. You could apply for certainly your dwellings that you had constructed, and any land around those dwellings that wouldn't begin to conflict with your neighbor's land and land that he used or land that he had built some of his structures on. It had to be land that the applicant, in fact, used. So you couldn't apply for your neighbor's house.
And also, one other question I asked was, how could they have known that they had to file for the land? Because there was no offices, there was a lack of communication, there was no mail coming in. The only means of transportation at that time was either by boat or by docking.
That is perhaps the greatest problem with the Allotment Act, is that no one knew about it until 1969 or 1971, you know, several decades after it was in fact passed. I will touch on that a little bit later on, but essentially it was, you might say it was BIA's responsibility to get out there and tell people about the land and help them, tell them about the application process, help them fill it out. But the only BIA office was in Juneau. So all your early applications, allotment applications, appear in the southeast. It's not until later on that you get applications from the Anchorage Fairbanks area. And your outlying areas, like along the coast in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta and up here on the North Slope, most of the applications fall within a period between 1968 or 69 and 1971, before the Act was repealed by the Claims Act.
And I have one other question. How could the people have lived there continuously? Because it was mandated by the Bureau of Indian Affairs that the people, well, the children get educated, and they had to move to Barrow from the Coal River area and different parts of the North Slope to follow the laws that were made by the federal government to educate their children. That's how come most of the people moved from the North Slope area to Barrow, where they had the school, so their children could go to school, because it was mandated.
Okay, perhaps I should qualify my statement that the use had to be substantially continuous. They do recognize seasonal uses of land. They know that you don't spend your full year at your fish camp, and that you don't spend a full year of time at your berry picking camp. So if you go there each berry picking season or each fishing season, that's substantially continuous as far as the Act is concerned. I'm well aware of your problem, and it's common amongst allotment applicants in that they're living in one spot, then BIA said, well, you have to move close to school so your kids can go to school. You could still have applied for the land where you used to live, and you could still apply for the land where you hunted or where you trapped or where you berry picked.
Somebody mentioned the fact that there was a rush to get land allotments. I know that happened because I was in high school at the time that happened, and my parents and my uncle Mark Pausner, David Pausner, and some of the group in our family went to Jack Chenoweth. He was a Alaska Legal Service. Was it Jack Chenoweth?
Yeah.
Jack Chenoweth, yeah. That's who we filed the land allotments with, because we follow land allotments that generally where my parents lived at the time before they moved here to Barrow.
Okay, let me see if I understand your question. You had filed native allotment applications with Jack Chenoweth?
Yes, that's true.
Do you have, does BLM have those on file now?
They look for them, but I think they lost them or something, but we could check into that.
Okay, I can certainly check on that for you and see if you do have a pending application, excuse me, before the Bureau of Land Management.
The allotment may have been filed under Mr. Pausana, or it may have been under Sarah Kunungnana, even though she doesn't have part of her native allotment in Puto right near Nuiqsut. But the problem was nobody knew where the records of that native allotment application was. I have looked into the problem and I found out that BLM had either lost it or sent it to Bethel, or it's floating somewhere up in the air still, even though she did make it right around 1970. And the problem with the native allotments is that we did get them in before December 31st, 1982, but there was no government agency to receive those native allotments, that applications. So what we have done now, this is what the Inuit community of the Arctic Slope was trying to do with all of the native allotments, with all the questions. We looked into the fact that that the kids now, when their parents had filed, did not have records, because their parents, some of the parents are, they are now gone, they're diseased. So when we started looking into the fact that these records supposedly had been with BLM, they weren't. They were either in Bethel, they were either in Juneau, they were either in Fairbanks, or they were in Anchorage, or they were in Seattle. We did find close to, with the restricted deeds, another problem is over 2,000 applicants. But half of those were never approved, or they were just because they could not get a hold of the people to resolve the problem of people, as you said, they were overriding each other because they were not told by BLM that they should not do this. I'm asking now, with Sarah Kunungnana's or Pausana's native allotments, that applicant was made, that application was made, but somehow or other, the industry or BLM had reason to make that disappear, because right in that area where her native allotment, where Pausana's native allotment, is a dock. Because in a lot of cases now, any native allotment is there, like Owenya's airport. Nobody has done nothing about it. It's Dead Horse Airport is right on his native allotment. BLM approved, and yet he never got nothing for it. Walton Mohawk is on the east dock. I may be wrong, might be west, I don't know. But hers happened to be in one of the docks there. But there was a house, and they were going to destroy it. What's your brother's name? Simeon Kunungnana was working for ARCO at that time. They told him, no way, you're not going to destroy my grandparents' house, which they were going to do. From there on, we lost track of where that application is. So it's not the record keeping of the people that made the application, it's the recipient of the application that we have no record of. Now, there should be some kind of resolve in being able to get these natives to more understand exactly what an application is and give them a chance to put in an application and be approved. We had a lot of tentative approval, blanket approvals, but nothing has been done by BLM or the Secretary of Interior. That's a little bit of what I know about the Native allotments, because I've worked with Native allotments for about 3 years with the legal services, with the Inuit Community Arctic Slope. In fact, I made it so the Native allotments that we could find, we could steal from BLM, from the Fairbanks Agency.
You mean the application forms?
Those applications that were made that was hidden. Some of them were, we even found some in the city of Barrow here. We found some on top of the old hotel that they had here. I mean, we literally stole those. Because these applications were good, and they were made in reference to the law that they were signed by the people, and yet they were just filed somewhere, so nobody could do nothing about them. And well, here, we're still in that same boat.
Maybe we could ask Mr. Florent to carry on and see if in the course of his presentation he can deal with some of these questions, and then we'll return to some of these other things a little later.
We did run across a similar situation to that, where applications have been filed by the natives and they have been misplaced, and we did bring suit, and it was settled out favorably for the applicants, and I will get into that a little bit later on. This might be a similar situation, and we can talk about it later.
Before we continue, I'd like to state one fact. What Raymond stated was the house that is right next to the dock for ARCO in Puda Bay. The Parsonet family lived there, and some people came in from University of Alaska and excavated the house, and they took some artifacts. But my sister was going to school at U of A in Fairbanks at the time, and we were able to get the artifacts back from U of A from Fairbanks. So my mother has the artifacts that they excavated from the house that the Parsons lived in a long time ago.
That is interesting.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Between 1906 and, say, the mid-1960s, there have been very few applications filed. I wish I could recall the exact numbers, but between, say, 1906 and perhaps 1959 or so, there may have been maybe 50 to 75 applications filed. As I mentioned earlier, most of these were in the Southeast because the Bureau of Indian Affairs had an office in the Southeast. So there was very little information throughout the state regarding Native allotment applications or how to file them or that you had the opportunity to file them. It just wasn't common knowledge.
I'm Mary Edwardson. I got two Native allotments in the Chip River area. In fact, we had three houses in Chip River area because, you know, one they call one Chip 1, Chip 2, and Chip 10. And there's another lot of houses in between Chip 2 and Chip 10. So we're the last ones up there and the first one down the river. So when I applied for this, for the Chip 2 and Chip 10, we wanted to include Chip 1, all right, but the guy that was giving us the allotment papers said, I can only apply for two. Like you said, I could have four tracks in there.
Mm-hmm.
But this guy, so how could that be, could something be done about that? Or, because we still got chip too, there's a house up there. That's our first house. And the chip too's got an isolator and everything in there.
To your specific question as to whether or not anything could be done at this time, I would perhaps suggest your best alternative would be, if that is Village Corporation land, is perhaps to apply for it under the 14C provisions. To get it into your native allotment application would be difficult in what we have to establish. We have to establish that you originally intended to apply for it. Great. We have your word for it, and that's generally fine. But what the BLM looks for is some type of indication in writing. For instance, if someone had applied for two parcels of land, and by the time BLM got the application, it only mentioned one parcel of land for 80 acres, what we would look for is perhaps that one parcel is described as parcel A, suggesting that there may have been a parcel B. If that parcel A was only for 80 acres, most people did sign up for the full acreage. On the other side of the form, there's a place where you can write in improvements. If the improvements listed there appeared on that parcel B, there's another indication that, okay, there was the intent to apply for a second parcel, and somewhere in the application process, it was lost. It's difficult to get those through. We're trying one now.
It hasn't been lost, but we were just misled. I could apply. He told me I could apply only for two. We tried to convince him to apply for three.
Now, so I should add, Mrs. Edwardson, at other villages we found that very same complaint. That is, people were told you can only apply for one. So that was the way the application went in. And now, to all intents and purposes, it's too late to do anything about it.
And yes. You were saying earlier that we could apply for four. That's why I had to bring this up.
Yeah, you could have applied for up to four as long as it didn't exceed 160 acres. You could apply for up to, say, four parcels of land,
right,
although it did not, so that the total did not exceed 160 acres, yeah. In a general statement, that was one of the initial problems about the whole act, is no one understood it. BIA and BLM had these people going out trying to assist native allotment applicants in filling out their forms, and although it was certainly full of good intentions, they misinformed quite a few people. Not intentionally, it's just that they didn't understand it. So you were limited to two parcels when in fact you could have picked up that third or the fourth. BLM's perspective on that is that, well, it's BIA's problem. You're not going to get your land out of that, but it's BIA's problem. And that is really unfortunate. That's one of the sadder things about the Allotment Act, is that when people were, in fact, finally informed about what they could do, many were incorrectly informed.
Did you want to have a question, ma'am?
Yes, please.
Could we have your name?
Sure. My name is Cora Sakiagak. I'm speaking primarily on behalf of my husband and the family, though I'm not from this area.
Where are you from?
I'm from Kotzebue.
Okay, well, that's good enough.
My husband and my family from here. I would like to respond to a comment the attorney made, in that he said that people were not informed of this, the Native Allotment Act, I guess, which brings to my family a lot of grief, because some of the members were not informed that they could file for the allotments, and time has passed where they cannot now. I wanted to ask if it was possible some way or another, through court or wherever, to open up the opportunity for the people that have not filed for allotments. Number one was, I have other questions, but I'll let you respond.
In answer to that question, I don't think we could do it through the court, since it was an act of Congress which repealed it. You'd have to go back through Congress and have them reopen an application period. You'd have to, say, contact your U.S. congressman and suggest that they try and get it reopened.
Thank you. That sounds like a solution perhaps we could work toward. The other thing is, if that is not possible, say for instance there's a lot of opposition to reopening the Allotment Act. I know that the people that have not applied for allotments could approach the village corporations for subsistence lands, although the areas they want are perhaps not as large as they would have gotten under the Act. I'm not quite sure if there is a maximum amount of acreage they could get, or are you aware?
As I understand, I'm not as familiar with 14C reconveyances as I am with allotments, but as I read it, there is no set acreage to be conveyed under 14C. I think it's essentially left up to the village corporation. I may be mistaken in that, but that's my general understanding at this time. Perhaps someone in the room would be more. Right.
Where a village can select land, but if there just happened to be a native allotment, it's on the site of village selection lands, the village would either have to give that person with a native allotment same amount of land outside the village selected area's land selection.
Part of the problem with that, and you raise a good point, where there is a conflict between village high seed lands and a native allotment. You mentioned that the village corporation could
I seed.
Right, their I seed. It's an interim conveyance.
Oh, interim conveyance. Yeah.
Sure.
Maybe Mr. Neocoff could just state that again for the record.
See, as I understand the 14C under village corporations, select land selections. If there is a native allotment in that village selected.